afternoon. This is Kevin Campanella welcoming you to Woodland Stars Radio. Here at Woodland Stars, we believe that every human on the planet has the power to use their thoughts to change events in the mundane world. This show is all about learning how to gain control of that creative process. So let's get started. My co-host is Ryan Scher. Hi, Ryan. What do we have on the agenda for today's show?
Well, Nevin, today is going to be exciting because we have a guest. Her name is Wambui Bahati. She is an actress, singer, writer, storyteller, inspirational motivational speaker. And she began her formal theatrical studies at New York University School of Arts. And she has made her professional debut in Godspell at Ford's Theater of Washington, D.C. And she went on to perform a Broadway production of Godspell and Jesus Christ Superstar. And many other feats that there's way too much to give in a little time. So why don't we go ahead and welcome her to the show.
Okay. Hi, Wambui. Welcome
hi.
To Woodland Stars Radio.
Oh, hi. I'm excited to be here.
You've got quite a background in the theater, singing, writing, storyteller. You're a woman of many talents. Now, I know you've spent a considerable amount of time as a motivational speaker. And according to your website, you have a special interest in EFT. Now, many of the listeners are not going to know what that is. So could you give us a short explanation of the emotional freedom technique?
I sure will. The best way I know to explain EFT is to say it's an emotional version of acupuncture, and I think most people know acupuncture with the needle, but this is without the needle. This is done with the tapping the meridians with your fingers instead of using needles, and it is based on the concept that, well, we have an energy system or systems that we have, a digestive system, a skeletal system, and all these systems, but we have paid very little attention to our energy system. And what emotional freedom techniques does is align the energy system so that once the energy is aligned, the concept is that the emotional and physical energies will also fall into place.
Before I forget, Wambui, why don't you mention how people might be able to purchase a copy of your self-help CD? Where do they go on the web, so on and so forth?
Oh, great. My website is my name, and I guess I should spell that. It's Wambui, W-A-M-B-U-I, hyphen, B-A-H-A-T-I.com, Wambui, hyphen, Bahati. .com, and you can find out about the CD there, and the CD, the fulfillment house is CD Baby, and it's a CD entitled How I Got Over How I Got Over Bipolar Disorder and Other Life Stuff.
Wonderful. Okay, let's get started. You're known as Miss Inspiration, and tonight, folks, we are not going to do an inspirational presentation. We are, in fact, going to interview Miss Inspiration. So, where were you born and raised? Let's start right at the beginning.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. I was born and raised in Greensboro, North Carolina. I was born in 1950, which puts me as a child during the segregation. And Greensboro, of course, is the home of the infamous Woolworths, of the infamous Woolworths sit-in. And so I grew up in that era, taking for granted not being able to go in the front door of certain establishments and not being able to sit down to eat a hot dog. I took those things for granted. And
wait a minute, did you have to also ride in the back of the bus and so on and so forth?
Almost definitely. Definitely. I remember there were, you know, separate water fountains and the whole gamut. It was the 50s and the early 60s when the things were really still very separated in North Carolina.
Yeah, you know, Wambui, I just turned 64 last Thursday, and people from my generation they're pretty short-sighted. You know, they keep saying things like, oh, you know, only the 50s were back. Let me tell you, the 50s were only nice for a few people, and others didn't do so well. Well, listen,
yes.
do you still have relatives there in North Carolina?
I do. I do have I have two brothers who live there, and most of my relatives, my older relatives, or my mother's sisters and her aunts and uncles, the older people are still down there in North Carolina. And the things, I never went to school with an integrated school until I went away to college. And
One second. You said you didn't go to school until you went to college?
I never went to an integrated school. I only went to school with black people. I never knew what it was like to go to school with white people or people of other races.
I guess that's really my next question. Growing up in North Carolina, compare that to today's world. I want you to compare for the audience. North Carolina, growing up in the 50s, and now what is it like today? I want to be fair to North Carolina.
North Carolina is, God, how do you say? Well, it's a whole different world, as you know. In fact, so many of the young people today, one of the things that I guess I have concerns about is that the young people take for granted all of the progress and all of the things that have happened, and few people know the real story or remember it or are keeping the story alive. So there's not a great appreciation for what went on before in the years before that allowed people to be able to go into a movie theater, for instance, in the front door. I couldn't go in the front door, or certain stores I couldn't go in, or even go to certain schools, or even...
As a child,
mm-hmm.
you must have felt something from that. What did you feel when you were being rejected, and did you know why?
Do you know, at the time, I took it all, I didn't know what to do with that, and so I know in school, the biggest heartbreak for me was when I could be at my school, and I could see the other kids, the white kids, at their school, and they had really nice playground equipment, and they had a lunchroom to go to, and we had like a little truck that would come with the milk, but we couldn't go down the hill and play on those swings and those things. And that was the only time it felt really bad, when I didn't understand how come those kids got to have really nice stuff and we didn't.
Did you ever try to challenge it as a child? In other words, did you violate the social norm in any way?
As a young child, I remember an incident where I went to have water from the wrong water fountain because it was a nicer water fountain, and I remember my mother yanking me and yelling at me because that was a very serious offense, and to drink from the wrong water fountain. I may not get in trouble because I was a child, but because she was my mother, the idea was they expected her to keep me in line. So in order for her not to be in trouble, she had to make sure that, you know, I didn't do that.
Yeah, you chose the mark. Well, now let me ask you a question. I've been through your website, and everything that you said in the past 10 minutes does not appear on your website. Why not?
Well, because the story is long and the story is really, really involved, and I try to keep, I don't want the audience, now I'm saying this on the air, but I don't want the audience to be focused on too many things. My main issues that I'm dealing with are the fact that I recovered from mental illness, and also that I am an advocate for domestic violence.
Yeah, folks, the listeners out there, please do go to her website if you get a chance. She's written a wonderful article on domestic violence, and I'll cover that in a bit. But Wambui, do you have brothers or sisters?
I have a sister here in New York, and she owns a small architect firm, and I have two brothers that are living in North Carolina at this time. My sister, at this time last year, which is very interesting because of the time we grew up, my sister, she invited me to Los Angeles at this time last year to see her get fellowed as an architect, which is a very big deal in the architect world. And the reason why that's so special to me is because we didn't know what an architect was when we were growing up. We didn't know any. And my sister somehow got this notion that she wanted to be that, and she knew someone who, she found someone who was that, and she decided she wanted to be that. And of course, being a black female, they tried to talk her out of that, and saying that you should be an art teacher if you like art, but you can't be an architect.
And did she in fact become an architect?
She in fact became an architect. She's very successful, and as I said, last summer, she received a fellow from the AIA, and which is a real big deal. Not everybody becomes a fellow. And,
no, not at all.
And so in the ceremony, I remember even crying because I just realized, you know, it brought back all those things. And, you know, and when I started, when I thought about this interview, I wasn't necessarily going to talk so much about the South and what happened. That's why it's not on the website. But talking about it, I guess it's, there are stories that need to be told, and that, as I said before, the stories are dying and nobody's keeping them alive.
Let me stop you for a second, Wambui.
Uh-huh.
I think it's important, at least for on this show, because what this show is all about is creating your own reality.
Uh-huh.
And that is, in fact, what the black community did. They grabbed a hold of the reality that they didn't like and said, whoa, wait a minute, this is not right. We're going to do something else. And they accomplished it, which to me is, you know, I mean, what a magnificent achievement. What happened in such a short period of time, I mean, obviously I didn't have to live it, so for people who were living it, it was a long time. But within a span of, you know, 30 years or so, 40 years, I mean, the black community got together and said it's time for a change. People had to sacrifice. Some sacrificed their life. So I believe that is part of creating your own reality, and the story needs to be told.
You know, it certainly is. And I guess I was even like almost starting to take it for granted myself. It's like, but I remember the marches. I remember Jesse Jackson and going to marching. We were told to march 2x2, and no matter what the people said to us, the racial slurs, if they spit on you, whatever, you were supposed to just keep that focus. And I think of it now as keeping the eye on the prize. You were just supposed to keep that focus and just look where you were going and just not let anybody stop you. And I know I was talking to my daughter the other day. She was asking me questions about this very thing, and I told her that one of the most interesting things I remember was during the marches, they started arresting all the demonstrators. And so at first, all the jails were filled. This is in Greensboro in the 60s. The jails were filled. Then we kept coming. Then the Coliseum was filled with demonstrators that had been arrested. But we kept coming. And then the armory, the guard armory, was filled. And I remember specifically going to the marches and the policemen giving you an option because they knew they couldn't arrest everybody anymore. And I remember them specifically saying, if you want to be arrested, because some of us were told we should not be arrested. My parents had told me, please don't get arrested. So it became an option. If you want to get arrested, come over here. If you don't want to get arrested, go over there. And I just find that so amazing.
Wembley, that really should be on your website. Comedy helps, and that in itself is a comedy of a really bad social dynamic. Let's get along here onto your extended family. Well, first of all, who did you get along with best of your siblings? Who were you closest to?
My sister, who is 2 years older than me, although if you speak to her, she'll tell you otherwise, I looked up to her, the one who's the architect. I have one sister. She's the one who introduced me to theater, and she used to write skits for me to do. And once I started doing theater, my whole life changed. I felt more comfortable on the stage than I did anywhere else. So
let me ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
Did she introduce you to mouse ears?
Yeah. Are you referring to the picture on the website?
Yeah, that's an amazing picture on the website. And, folks, you get a chance, get to Wambui's website. You have got to see this picture. We've got four children lined up from the tallest to the shortest. One of them, I think, is a neighbor.
Yes.
And Wambui is, she's got her sister on her right and her brother, I think, on her left.
Yes.
And they're wearing mouse ears.
Yes.
How'd that come about?
Well, that was, the Mouseketeer show was one of our favorite shows, next to Superman. And so what we wanted was Mouseketeer ears, and it took forever for us to get them. And I remember that day my mother came home with Mouseketeer ears for us, and so we just were so proud.
it's really a great picture. What was Joel like? You haven't really mentioned much about him.
Okay, Joel, my brother, is he's a chef in North Carolina, and... what can I say about Joel? He has the kindest, most tenderest heart. That he is the kind of, unfortunately, he is married to women, but he's the kind of man that every woman will want to marry. He's just a real gentle soul and a kind person. And just, I can't say enough about him in that capacity. When we were little, I used to help him with his paper route and things like that. He was not very, he was, you know, my sister and I were very, very good in school, and he was not. And so he got in trouble a lot for that, but it's not that, you know, I just felt like I still do believe that some people, you should teach them a trade. And I don't mean that in a sarcastic, bad way, but school is not their thing. And so he needed to, you know, and so he just, later on he discovered cooking, and he, like I said, he became a really good chef. So in school he was given a real hard time, especially because he had to follow me and my sister, who did really well in school, and I used to feel so bad for him because it seemed like nobody just understood, you know, that he was doing the best he could do in school at that time. And now he's
uh-huh.
just this fabulous person, and he does, you know, filming and, you know, videos and all. He's just a real great person, but no one was tapping into his other talents at that time.
You mentioned that you have two brothers, and what's your other brother's name?
My other brother is Justin, and Justin is retired from the Navy and now works for the Sheriff's Department in Guilford County, North Carolina.
Oh, and Ryan, that's right. That's right up Ryan's alley. Ryan is a retired state patrolman.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So, and I always say because of, you know, my mental health history, I always say if you've ever had been diagnosed with a mental illness, you want to have a friend in the sheriff's department.
Do you hear that, Ryan?
Or plus, if you have.
When I get ready to pull you away, I'm going to have to call Ryan. Or maybe I'll have to call Wambui. Okay, let's get to Mom and Dad.
My mother at this time lives in New York City, a few blocks from me, with my sister, the architect. My mother has Alzheimer's at this time. When we were younger, she did, when I was very young, she did what they used to call day work, and that is to go clean white people's houses. And I believe it was for like maybe $1 an hour, but it was not more than $1 an hour that these women would make, somewhere between 50 cents and $1 an hour they were making to clean the houses. And then,
how did your mom and dad make the transition from, North Carolina to New York?
I didn't explain that well. My father passed away about 20 years ago now. My mother was still living in North Carolina and my brothers were, you know, watching after her. And then she developed Alzheimer's to the point where she had to be put in a home. And my sister made an unexpected visit at the home one day and could not believe how my mother was being treated, and immediately took my mother out of the home and brought her up here to New York.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so that's how my mother got here.
When with Mom and Dad, who doled out the discipline, Mom or Dad?
Well, I'm Mom. Mom, definitely. Mom rules. Mom rules. Mom, yes, she was in charge. She was definitely in charge. My father, I think I got my sense of humor from my father. And it's really strange because I think I got my sense of humor from my father, but I think I got my acting talent from my mother, because my mother was quite a character. And I always used to think that in some other life she must have been an actress somewhere.
Oh, maybe so. Also, folks, there is a very charming picture of her mom and dad. Her mother's beautiful. You get a chance, go take a look. And Dad looks really big. He looks like a really big man in the picture.
Served in World War II, and upon returning, was one of the men who had a personality change, in that he was just very quiet. In fact, some of the people that worked with him after he came back, he worked at the post office, for the United States Post Office, and his friends used to call him "Say Nothing, Wash." And he eventually became an alcoholic. He was a genius. My father was an absolute genius, was an alcoholic. And I guess because of the frustration of he never talked about what happened, you know, in the war. And I think the frustration of being a genius, but because the things were so limited for black people, and the black men were not really given the same respect. So I don't know what all the frustrations were about, but he wrote poetry. I have books with his poetry in it. He wrote songs. He could fix anything electrical. People would drop off their TVs and radios at our house. My mother didn't like that so much, to have a room full of broken TVs. But he could fix
today's world, a lot of people out there, Warren Bowie, do not realize that TVs at one time were actually repairable. Today it's all disposable. Our audience is pretty young, and most of them grew up with, you know, disposable TVs.
Yeah, but then the audience probably doesn't also that there used to be only three channels.
Oh yeah,
three.
And the screen on a television was like 6 or 7 inches, and I remember myself, the TV repairman coming over, changing tubes in this monstrous electrical thing. You know, and totally amazing.
Yeah,
I side with the audience on that one. I'm a little young for replaceable TV.
Well, by the way, folks, Ryan is not going to get away with this. Wambooey and I have announced our age. Ryan is 12.
I'll be 15 soon.
Wambooey, what about high school sweethearts? Any name come to mind? Did you fall in love with them?
I was so shy in that department, and so, you know, my mother had one saying. She would say, "It's easy to get in trouble, but it's hard to get out." And we had no idea what that meant, but it scared us to death.
I should have that printed across my forehead.
And so I was very shy. I was very scared. I was very uncomfortable in dating situations and in male-female situations. I was uncomfortable. So in high school, I was always the pal. Like, the boys would call me to tell me they liked somebody, and would I tell her.
Okay.
And I can't say that there were, you know, a few guys I didn't have a crush on, guys that didn't have a crush on me. And when I went to my prom, I had a really nice date for my prom. And I must tell you, I wore a mini to my prom because by that time I was in a rebellious stage. So instead of the regular prom dress, I wore a silver mini. But, and false eyelashes.
Listen, your name, Wambooey. Obviously, there aren't too many people named Wambooey. How did that come about?
Wambooey is the Swahili word that means singer of songs. and Bahati is the Swahili for "My fortune is good." Now,
what prompted the change in the name? How
the name came about? I guess it's been about 12, 13 years ago now. I was in the process of reinventing myself, and so while I was, that was during the period when I was finally getting it about changing your thoughts and that whole thing, and I decided I wanted a name that meant something to me, because I had been named after my father. My name was John, J-O-H-N, and my middle name was Ann, and my name was John Ann Washington. And I decided I wanted a name that really spoke to me, and I chose Wambui because it meant singer of song, and also because I thought of all the African names, that was something that somebody could pronounce.
Well, this is not unusual in today's world, especially among New Age type people, and in fact, the name Nevin is certainly not my birth name.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted, also, folks, I went through a similar process and wanted to do some reinvention of me.
Okay.
My legal name is Sam. And
oh, okay.
I set out on a quest. I was anxious to reinvent, and I chose the name Nevin from a Catherine Kerr novel. There was a character in in the novel whose character was so intriguing and seemed so wholesome that I wanted to adopt that character, and I thought by taking on the name, that would help me move along, which, by the way, Nevin, at least in terms of the book, it means no one.
Okay.
We know how you got started in acting. Your sister kind of got you into that. Now, I want to get on to some of the harder stuff here, and I know we're going to go over time. Is that okay, Rambouille?
That's fine with me.
Okay.
Okay.
We've got your background, but we know you went into acting. Now, all of a sudden, tragedy, we get mental illness.
Okay,
happened?
Okay, let me back up just a little bit, though, because I want to really put this in here, because this tells how I got to New York in the first place, and it involves the first time I realized what a miracle was. And it had to do with the fact that in high school, I read about this school up in New York City where you could study acting all day long, but you didn't have to take any science or math. And so I decided I wanted to go to that school, and the school happened to be New York University, and they had just opened a new school of the arts in 67, and I wanted to be a part of the school. And the long and short of it is I got all this stuff together they said I needed to get, and then, of course, when it was time to send it in, I read the small print, and you need to send $100, non-refundable deposit, with just the application. Well, my mother and father heard that, and they just thought that was the funniest thing in the world. But then, about a month later, my mother did give me the money, because I think just to shut me up, because I was on her every day about this $100. And in those days, you could go to a loan company. She went to a loan company. She got the $100. And I sent in the application. I got an audition in Washington, D.C. Now, I had never been out of the Carolinas, so this was a big deal, too. So I went to the audition. I got accepted into the school. When we saw how much the school cost more than everybody on my block made collectively in one year. And so that was, like, not going to happen. So I was preparing to go to Howard University, where my sister was, to be in that acting program. But in the back of my head, I kept thinking, as soon as I get to Howard, I'm going to go to New York as quickly as I can.
And
well,
so did you go to Howard University?
The day before I was to leave for Howard, we got a telegram. Remember telegrams?
Yeah.
And a yellow envelope. The telegram said,
folks, telegram is paper with words written on it. Most people in cyberspace don't understand writing, but go ahead.
The telegram said, "Dear Miss Washington," remember how they would say stop? "Dear Miss Washington, due to the untimely death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., monies have been made available to bring more minorities into our program. Congratulations, you have been awarded a Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. scholarship to New York University School of the Arts."
Wow.
And that's how I got to New York University School
of the Arts. Okay, wonderful, wonderful.
And now the mental illness issue kind of grew out of that. That was a miracle. I went there. It was the greatest moment of my life, one of them. And but what happened is, in retrospect, I realized I wasn't prepared. I mean, I was living not only in a dorm with people of different races. I was living in a dorm with men. It was a co-ed dorm. I was there were hippies all around. My clothes matched, and my hair was straight, and I used to curl it, roll it in the morning, you know, to look nice. So the black people were saying I wasn't black enough, and the white people were saying I was black.
You didn't fit anywhere.
I was just kind of lost, and again, there was the female and male issues. I wasn't sure how to, you know, deal with that, how to deal with men. I was just out here in this. I was in this place where there were, in my acting school, people were talking about programs they had studied, had been to in Europe and all over the world, and I had never done any of that. And I.
Oh, you have with mouse ears.
Yes, I had mouse ears. And so I was kind of like in this, and of course drugs were on the scene everywhere. And I was kind of like not sure. I didn't know what to do with
my. You didn't have any self-confidence.
Totally lost, and I tried to put up a front.
Hmm? You had no self-confidence left.
I had no self-confidence. My self-esteem was non-existent, and I had no idea how I was supposed to deal with all these new issues that I had to deal with. And there was nobody there to show me how. Eventually, what happened is the first time we realized there was something wrong that was not quite right was I was on my way to my dance class. This was when I was in my second year. On my way to my dance class, I lived two blocks away. I had moved out of the dorm by then, and actually my sister was in New York, and we were sharing an apartment. She was at Columbia University now. We shared an apartment. The school was two blocks away. Somewhere between my house and the school, I decided I needed to go to Los Angeles, California. I had $20, some dance clothes, and a TWA charge card.
Well, hold on, Rambo. You need to explain to the audience the disorder and how the excitement leads to decisions, like taking off the LA with $20 in your pocket. Give them the diagnosis.
Okay. Well, I was diagnosed years after this, many years after this, with a bipolar disorder.
Which folks used to be called manic depression.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, though, Kate, I wasn't diagnosed with bipolar until I was 44. At this time, I'm 19. And I don't know what's going on here. And but I have this urge that I have to go. And what bipolar is, I guess I should explain that too, is called bipolar because there are two ends to it. There's the end where first of all, you're so depressed that you're suicidal. Or you can be so high and just so, you feel invincible and that you can do anything, and most of it is irrational stuff.
Which led to you wanting to go to L.A. with $20.
Right. And to me, at that moment, it felt very comfortable. I felt, okay, let's do this. And I went to the airport, I charged this ticket, and I was acting as if I had planned this trip, like, for months in advance. I just felt I remember feeling so good about this. And by the time I got to L.A., I had less than $20 now because I got hungry and I had a few candy bars along the way. When I get to L.A., now my mind is, like, really racing. It's spinning. I don't know what's going on. I only know one thing to tell the taxi driver, Hollywood and Vine, because I've heard that in movies and on TV. I don't know L.A. I say Hollywood and Vine, so we go to Hollywood and Vine. I get out. And I was in L.A. for 4 months. Most of what happened, I don't remember. and I really think that's a really good thing. I do know that I was homeless. I was one of those people that I would go to the telephone booths and search for change. I remember eating a lot of popcorn because popcorn was really cheap. I remember spending nights on the beach. I went 4 months later into this. It was like I woke up from this dream, and it was like, oh, my, in between that, in the interim, my family says that I flew home to North Carolina, announced I was getting married, and flew back to California. I have no recollection of that.
But maybe in a way, that's a blessing not to have all that memory of such tragedy of self-esteem and so on and so forth.
I believe so. In fact, I went to a hypnotist a few years back, and I said, I want to know what happened when I was in California. And he said, no, you don't. And I said, okay. So I never pursued it after that. But after I returned from California, it was like business as usual because nobody knew what that was, at least nobody who I knew. And I wasn't talking about it very much because it was embarrassing.
How did you eventually resolve the whole mental health issue? I mean, what you must have gotten help or treatment along the way somewhere.
Well, after that trip, I started suffering from real bad depression on and off, and so I knew enough that when I was depressed, I sought help for that. In the interim, I went on to do my theater career, and I had a pretty fruitful career, and I was not always totally present. However, I was present when I hit the stage. I was present when I hit the stage, and that was my lifeline, performing. And
that kept you focused.
Tell me along the way
of your entire career with the mental health issue, what kind of love relationships have gone on? Do you have a significant? Did you have any significant others in your life?
I've been married twice. So my first husband, I married. I got to tell you this. I went my first professional show was a show called Godspell at Ford's Theater in Washington D.C. And the show ran about almost 2 years, I believe. And during that period, I attempted suicide. I'd been doing the show for more than a year. And everything in my life you would think was great. I mean, it looked great, and it should have been great. I was making a lot of money. People loved us. We were the creme de creme of Washington, D.C. You know, the Shrivers would invite us over on our day off. But I was not happy, so really not happy. Something was just missing, and so I overdosed. But I came to, and that was my first admission to a psychiatric hospital.
Whoa! You said you overdosed. Tell the audience exactly how. I mean, let them know.
Okay. What happened is
I was
living in a really nice penthouse apartment in Maryland, and one morning I just. The depression was such that I just did not want to live.
So you were in fact suicidal at the time.
I was, and so I had some antidepressants which were prescribed for me. I didn't drink, but I remember going downstairs and waiting for the liquor store to open. So I got a bottle of J&B, and I took the bottle of J&B back upstairs. And I drank the J&B and took the antidepressants, and that was it. I mean, the good news is people were trying to call me and got concerned that I wasn't answering, or somebody said I answered and I just sounded really not well. And
okay,
so
how long ago was that incident?
We're talking about 1973 or 4.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I was 4.
And Brian wasn't born.
When I said that he was 12, I wasn't that far off. All right. You managed in your on your website, you... I want to let's get off of the mental health issue here, and also we're going to start running out of time pretty quick.
Okay.
I want to get into domestic violence and your knowledge of it and how you became involved with dealing with the terrible issue of domestic violence. What happened?
Okay. Well, my first husband was abusive, but again, almost like mental illness, I didn't know enough to know exactly what was going on. I had enough sense to know I had to get out of here, and I did. But I never talked about that either. In fact, when I left, I was seen as the bad guy because I never told anybody what was going on. So they just said, oh, do you believe she left him? I can't believe she just left like that. And so I never talked about that. I got to go back to the mental illness a little bit. What happened was with the mental illness I started writing the show. I wrote a show about it called Balancing Act, which is a musical show, which was optioned for Off-Broadway. And we've done it here in New York at some clubs here in New York. And I travel around the country doing the show. I consider myself healed. I consider myself healed from mental illness. And that's a whole other program, I guess. But right now... What happened is people saw the Balancing Act show, and they said, well, can you write a show like that that deals with domestic violence? And so I said, well, okay, I'll do that. And so I wrote this show in which I personify domestic violence. I am domestic violence. And so I did the show. It was for a Y in North Carolina for what I thought was a one-time thing. Did the show, and then after I did the show, word of mouth, because at the time I wasn't talking about the show, word of mouth spread, and next thing I know, I was being asked to come to the show at various schools, various colleges, at conventions, many of the national coalitions against domestic violence affiliates have invited me to do the performance and to open up conferences with the performance, and I'm scheduled, actually, next month I'm going to Baton Rouge and I'm going to Sacramento to do the I Am Domestic Violence show. And so it has become this, and it's during this show that I finally started to admit that yes, I had these issues. And so through that now, I was an advocate, but I was trying to, I guess it's kind of like when you ask me about the, what was going on about during segregation in the South, it's like sometimes I feel like there's so many things that I've experienced that I feel like people don't believe that I could have gone through that many things and that I can do that many things. So I was just trying to deal with the mental health show and let people know, okay, I had mental illness. And I didn't want to also say, okay, now I'm doing a domestic violence show, and oh, yes, I had that too. and so I just was trying to streamline things. But the more I did the show and people would ask me questions about the show, in order to be honest, I had to say, well, yes, I did experience that.
Well, let me break in here for a minute. Folks, the show that she's going to do, I Am Domestic Violence, is Tuesday, September 4th at the Louisiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence at the Marriott Hotel. Before we run out of time, give us a few of the warning signs. You've got a number of them on your website, but just give out two or three of the most important.
Well, first of all, if you feel uncomfortable, if you feel that you can't voice your opinion or be yourself in a relationship, that's the number one sign. You should never feel that you have to change in order to be accepted. Then secondly, if somebody is trying to cut you off from your friends, if they don't ever want to do anything with your friends or they don't want you to spend time with your family, then that's also a warning sign. And also, a lot of people feel that, and I'm going to say woman because it's usually women more women are in abusive situations than men, although men are too. But if a lot of women feel that if a man is jealous of them or if he wants to know your every move and who you were with, They think, oh, he's jealous. He just wants to know, and I'm so happy he's jealous. Well, that's very bad. That's not a good thing for someone to be jealous of you and to want to know your every move and to want to know who you're with. And I just want to interject, one of the biggest problem today with domestic violence is that it's going younger and it's going older. There is a great, the younger kids in school, in high school, junior high school, are having problems where their boyfriends are controlling them and actually beating them, and they thinking, and the young kids are thinking that means he loves me. They really think that's a sign that he cares if he will beat me up because I did something wrong.
Yeah, it sounds strange, I know, but there really are young women who somehow think it's some sort of sign of affection. Folks, please, if you are involved with the domestic violence issue, go to Wambui's website, check it out, and get help. Also, one of the most important things that you mentioned on your website, and I think you know that I've spent many years as a psychologist.
Yes.
The most important issue in terms of for this whole domestic violence issue, don't settle. You know, that is so important that people need to feel confident in themselves, and they don't have to settle for this person or that person.
Well, another very important thing to remember is domestic violence is not only physical. A lot of it's mental as well. A lot of people would think, oh, well, he doesn't beat me up, so it's not domestic violence.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Not true.
There's
the
a character in my
domestic
show named
violence
George.
Of the controlling them or browbeating them or trying to, you know, beat somebody in submission with your mind is just as powerful as using your fist.
Oh, yeah. You know, folks, Ryan's making an important point here. And you know what? It starts small. I've seen it happen where people start picking on each other and then contradicting each other constantly, especially in public, and then pretty soon it's an emotional battering going on. Listen, folks, the interview has been great, but we're going to have to bring this to a close. But before I do, I have a couple of questions to ask Wambui.
Okay.
Would you be willing to come back on the show next week?
Oh, I would be honored to, yes.
Okay, now I have another question for you, and that is, I know you're a good presenter, and I know you're a theater person, and as a matter of fact, I listen to your voice, but I want you to come back on the show to do an interview of me. How would you feel about that?
Wow! I'm going to take that challenge.
Okay.
Wow.
You heard it, folks. Next week, Wambui, and with the help of my 12-year-old Golos, Wambui is going to interview me. And I think it ought to be an interesting, fascinating time. For me, for sure.
Well, I think it's going to be great.
Okay, I'll tell you what. Ryan will get in touch with you with the details, okay?
Okay, great.
And we thank you for coming on our show today, and boy, I really look forward to next week's show.
Well, me too. Thank you so much. This has been so much fun. Thank you, everybody.
Well, thank you. It was wonderful having you on the show, Emily.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, folks, that was an absolutely fascinating interview. I know we have a very young audience out there. We don't usually get, you know, 60 or 70-year-olds, or not very many of them, listening to net radio. But a lot of people simply do not know what happened back in the 50s, and I'm going to try to encourage Wambui to do a bit more on her website and keep the story alive, as she said. How do you feel about it, Ryan?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, it's been said a million times that if we don't know our history, then we're destined to repeat it. And
oh,
I think a lot
yeah.
of things that have happened in our history, whether it be segregation, whether it be war, times of crisis that have happened, if we don't know them and understand, or at least have a basic principle as to why things like that happen. And sometimes there's no reason. There's no rhyme or reason. But I think that it's very important that we know that these things have happened and what has been done to these people so that you can kind of look into their mind and see why they feel the way they feel or why maybe they do some of the things they do. And
yeah,
that's very important.
One of the things that Wambui said that really struck a chord with me is how the young black community today kind of takes everything for granted. They
right.
don't realize the intensity of the effort and what it took to be able to go drink out of any damn water fountain you want to, or
right.
go to a bathroom, well, whichever. And you know, and that's kind of like everything, folks. We have a tendency to take things for granted. We do it in our own country. I mean, look at what it took to just get this country going. And today we take everything for granted. I made a statement somewhere on my website, and I'm going to get on a soapbox here. Our country, the United States of America, we are taking too much for granted. We've become too soft, too lazy, and we live and survive on bad carbs and fast food. And a lot of our population have turned into walking marshmallows. We've taken our independence for granted. And I'm telling you, folks, you're going to have to shape up because at some point, you're going to have a little bit more energy to hold on to our independence and freedom. And we take too much for granted.
Well, we rely way too much on the government as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a big handout. Give me this, give me that. And, well, you know, I remember the days of the fierceness that went on. I'll give you an example. I was a young psychologist working in, Pocatello, Idaho. It was my first job. I was a school psychologist. And it was at that time that Dr. King was shot. Now, I had spent most of my young career. I was in a university all the time, and so I really wasn't that involved in the social issues going on in communities. So one afternoon, the afternoon after he had been shot, I went over to a place I used to get lunch, and the person that owned the lunch counter or whatever it was. They were talking about Dr. King having been shot, and you know, I was aware of what had happened, and that was a terrible tragedy. Would you believe that? This was probably like 67, 68. Forgive me if I get the date wrong, but the person who owned the lunch counter actually made the statement that, quote, well, he wouldn't have gotten shot if he hadn't have been there. What the hell is that supposed to mean? In other words, all of a sudden, this man is kind of sort of excusing this assassination because he didn't believe Martin Luther King belonged where he was. I mean, I was totally blown away. Now, I got to tell you, I never went back to that lunch counter. I never confronted the man. I didn't. I was too young, and I was really upset by what he had said, but I didn't know how to deal with it. And the only way I could deal with it was I just simply never went back there for lunch again. But that also, there was an incident that occurred back in 62 or 63. I had a friend of mine. He was black, and he was from the L.A. area. Anyway, he decided to get married, and I think this was around 63. I know it was before Kennedy was assassinated. He got married. This was in Logan, Utah, folks. That's where I got my bachelor's degree, in Logan, Utah. He got married. He brings his wife to Logan. His wife was white. He could not get an apartment. That was in Logan, Utah, 1963. I hope the listeners are out there listening. Can you believe that? You think things like that don't happen? Well, they do. He came to me and he said, Sam, he said, I need some help. We got no place to live. Nobody will rent to us, you know, because it's a black-white couple. So I went, you know what? It must have been late 64, I think. Yeah, I think it was late 64, because my then fiance helped me go find an apartment. We rented the apartment, and they moved in. And that's how we dealt with it. That stuff is real, folks. I mean, it went on.
You know, racism still lives today in a lot of people.
It
really does. And, I mean, it's not as prevalent as it used to be, and it's not as widely accepted as it used to be. But I can tell you, speaking from being in positions, my ex, she was black, and my daughter is part black and white. Obviously, I'm white. My ex was black. She's, you know, mixed. And we ran into a lot of that.
Oh, I'm sure you did. And as young as you are, in today's age, you're going to run into it, especially probably, you know, if you're not living on the coast, the further inland you live, the probably the more funny looks you're going to get. I'm guessing at that, but that's what I suspect.
Yeah, even in little Podunk, Ohio, you know, you have people that still have the old mentality, if you will, the old messed up mentality of, you know, me, I've never seen black, white, blue, green, orange, purple. It doesn't make any difference to me what color you are. It doesn't make any difference to me what nationality you are.
Oh, you know, I got to tell you.
Person, you're a decent person.
Sometimes, though, folks, it can get where people are trying to be politically correct. Sometimes it can get really strange. There was a little incident that took place. This was at the University of Montana, and I was a student. I was working on my doctorate. And I was in the front office, and this young graduate student had just gotten into graduate school, comes in running into the office, and he's looking for such and such person, okay? And he's trying to describe to me who this person is. And he's going on and on and on, but he couldn't remember the person's name. He says, but he's one of the advanced students in the graduate department, in the graduate school. He was close to his doctor, and he's going on and on. This young man, must have spent 10 minutes trying to jog my memory as to who it was he was looking for. Finally, I looked at him, and I said, Jesus, you know, I just can't think of anybody. Isn't there anything that you could tell me other than what you have? And after 10 minutes, he finally says, well, he's Oriental. I said, for crying out loud, why didn't you tell me that to begin with? I mean, it would have made my life a lot easier.
Yeah, it would have narrowed it down.
Yeah, I mean, it would have narrowed it down. So,
in law enforcement, it was the same way. You're trying to give a description of somebody who mugged somebody or something like that. And it's funny, they make you take what's called a cultural sensitivity class. And in this class, they basically tell you, you know, you need to be, you know, sensitive to other people's cultures, you know, whether it be black or Asian or whatever, you know, the case may be. And you have officers that come out there, and they're afraid to say, you know, a black male, you know, between the hours, you know, the age of 25, 35, you know, or an Oriental male. I mean, you got to narrow it down, folks. And the fact of the matter is, being black, that's not a bad word, you know.
No,
being Oriental,
you know,
being white is not a bad, you know. But people start to treat it like it is, and I think we actually in this country have gone way far the other way.
Yeah, we really have.
Need to come back and meet the middle where the common sense is at.
Yeah, common sense. There's the key issue, folks, common sense. We are probably starting to run out of time, and I have a one-minute warning. Okay, well, listen, folks. We are going to have a wonderful show next week, and honestly, we are going to get back to Dr. Campanella's notes on creating your own reality, but we have so many interesting things to do, and we will tie these in. Believe me, this show is going to take off. Any last words, Ryan?
Nope. I just like to say, like I always do, you know, live your life without fear. You know, that's a very important thing.
Wow, live your life without fear. Folks, take Ryan's words. Write them on your refrigerator. Thank you for joining with us today. It was an absolutely wonderful experience. Till next week, this is Nevin Campanella wishing you all a fantastic and joyous journey of self-discovery. Say goodnight, Ryan.
Good night, folks. We love you.